This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Since the bombs exploded at the finish line of the Boston Marathon more than 2 years ago, the victims and this city have gone through a lot. The attack, then an intense manhunt, an arrest, then a long trial, and last month, a sentence of death for Jahar Tsarnaev.
Tomorrow, another piece of this long, painful drama will play out. One by one, as many as 30 people will have a chance to confront Tsarnaev, the convicted bomber, face to face, before Judge George O'Toole officially imposes the death penalty. WBUR senior reporter David Boeri is here to talk about what will happen in federal court. And David, good to see you.
Thanks, Anthony.
So what do you expect to hear from these victim impact statements?
Well, from the rest of the trial, I think we can expect that these impact statements are going to be raw. They're going to be filled with pain, grief, touched with horror, and just unspeakably sad. And they come when they will have absolutely no effect on the sentence that's then read.
Yeah, it's so interesting, this part of the proceedings. Of course, Judge O'Toole is obligated to impose the death penalty. So why go through this exercise?
It's all part of victim impact statements and the evolution of victim impact statements since the 1990s when they first came into play in federal court. The first rationale for victim impact statements is to give the judge who's about to sentence the defendant some clear information from someone who is in a unique position, namely the victim, the person that looked down the barrel of the gun or that sustained the damage. But of course, in this trial, the jury back on May 15th convicted Tsarnaev and sentenced him to death. So it's going to have no play here, which then puts a spotlight on the other rationales that are given for making victim impact statements. Susan Bandes teaches law at DePaul University. She's also studying the role of emotion and the law. Here's what she had to say.
It seems that they're being very specifically billed as an opportunity for the victims' families and the victims to try for this cathartic or healing effect and to face the defendant, look him in the eye and tell him how they feel.
Interesting, David, that we heard about the issue of victim impact statements in Charleston last week after the church shootings. There were victim impact statements at a bond hearing.
Right. And this shows how widespread they've become. And this whole idea of victims' rights in the court, that they have a place, and that by participating in justice, participating in the proceedings, of stating what happened to them, they can find therapy, the advocates say, that they're part of that process, they can move on with their lives. That's the way it's sold. But here, of course, you have this case that it just doesn't seem to make much sense. It's going to be a regeneration of what we've heard earlier, although it will come in speeches, allocution from those victims.
Hmm. So Judge O'Toole will be sentencing Tsarnaev to death no matter what. Has he placed any limits on what can be said and who can say it?
There's very little in that sense. It's the discretion of the judge. I mean, the right is that's recognized in all the state courts of the United States and the federal court is that the victim has a right to make a reasonable right a right to make a reasonable statement in court, meaning a certain amount of time, obviously. Here you have 260 victims. You couldn't put them all in to victim impact statements, but they have a right to be reasonably heard. These can be, and I've seen them, in the case of Catherine Gregg, who harbored Whitey Bulger. The proceedings, the victim impact statements, were raw, crude, cruel. One of the victims called her a dirty bitch. Another one referred to her brother, who had committed suicide, saying, "If I had a sister like you, I'd commit suicide, too." They were really raw, and the judge acknowledged it, but the judge allowed them to be said.
And so what do we know about who's going to be speaking tomorrow?
We know one person or a couple of people who have told me they're going to be speaking tomorrow. One of them is Liz Norden. She plans to deliver that statement. She's told me that she's been advised by the U.S. Attorney's Office to keep it to about 5 minutes. And here's why she wants to do it.
I have to literally watch my boys every day put their legs on. Nobody understands or could even pretend to understand the hell that we've gone through. I want to let people know.
She wants justice, she said. And it's interesting because people, victims, take different approaches. They respond differently to the circumstances and to the trial. She has two sons, JP and Paul Norden, both of whom lost their legs. They were roofers beforehand, so they've become amputees, lost their jobs. They haven't attended the trial. They're just getting on with their lives. She says they're ready to move on. She isn't. So there you get this sense of perhaps therapy that's going to be involved for her tomorrow.
David, I'm wondering, you know, during the trial, we heard from the family of Martin Richard, who said they were opposed to the death penalty. Will we be hearing from anyone tomorrow who expresses opposition to this sentence of death?
So it's interesting. The Supreme Court, which allowed victim impact statements for the first time in the early 1990s, didn't speak to this other aspect of whether or not victims can recommend sentences. So all the courts in the country, have, except for Oklahoma's, have prohibited victims from making recommendations as to the sentence. Now, the irony here is that people, victims who were critical to the government's convincing the jurors to impose the death penalty, opposed the death penalty. They reached out to the U.S. attorney and to U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder saying, please don't pursue this. And obviously, they didn't get anywhere because we have a death penalty trial. So they would not be able to say that in their victim impact statements. But in this case, you know, the key here was victim impact testimony that was done during the second phase, and that was sworn. It was under the possible cross-examination, and that's where that took. But now we go to this other process tomorrow, and it's remarkably different.
Mm. And finally, David, it sort of does feel like this should be the sort of final moment of this long process, but of course it won't be necessarily.
There is no finality here. We are going to have post-trial motions. There are going to be appeals. We know that this could take 20 plays. Somebody talking about victim impact statements and this idea of closure said the only closure you have in a death penalty case is to the defendant, and even sometimes he doesn't get it because it's never resolved.
David Boeri is a senior reporter for WBUR and co-host of the Finish Line podcast on the trial of Jahar Tsarnaev. He was talking about victim impact statements, which will be heard tomorrow when Jahar Tsarnaev is sentenced to death in federal court in Boston. David, thank you.
You're welcome.
Time now for the latest installment of the Remembrance Project, our series of stories from writer Alyssa Eli about ordinary people who lived extraordinary lives.
Doug Ashford died February 26th in Concord, New Hampshire. He was 53 years old. When it came to music, his most essential nutrient, he bought vinyl records and later CDs like other people buy morning coffee. Friends used to play a recognition game with him they called Stump Doug. And over decades, in every style, from gamelan to Celtic to Zydeco to Dan Zanes to Richard Thompson to John Denver, Doug missed a musical fragment only twice. He was a humble evangelist for eclecticism and inclusiveness, kind of a music whisperer. Doug could seg between non-adjacent styles with such genius that there was no question they belonged together, even though they never had before. His largest listening congregation was for Morning Soup, a folk jazz show he hosted every Saturday from 10 to noon on Boston Free Radio. Lucky Friends, those unsuccessful stumpers, also got an annual Best Of CD each year, with personal liner notes they could savor over the next 12 months. Though self-effacing and retiring in life, he liked to be heard more than seen and receded to the back of any photo. Doug could be ruthless in criticism. The cover artwork for this CD is the year's worst, he wrote about one selection. It is rather unspeakable. Boston Free Radio, where Doug was the unpaid program director, epitomized a free speech forum. For $60 a year, anyone could host an online radio show on almost any topic. There were series on high school sports, widowhood, the secret lives of stuffed animals, and, of course, music. Doug embraced them all. He fell in love many times with music, radio, friends, Wolferman's English muffins, and delighted in introducing one passion to another. After a quest to a Zydeco and Cajun music festival in Louisiana, he returned with dozens of jars of olive jam that were pressed on Friends, a As far as he was concerned, it was a natural combination. There were grand open events, like the annual all-night sci-fi movie party, where guests brought fuzzy slippers. At the same time, Doug was intensely private. One night, a dear friend was stunned by a phone call. She'd known he was battling cancer, but, he explained apologetically, he wasn't going to be able to attend the concert she'd bought them tickets for. He was going into hospice the next day. At his memorial, friends made his bread maker bread, ate his favorite burritos, and shared his apple pie recipe, the one that had won their blind taste test year after year. His 2002 Best Of CD played in the background, and after a while the liner notes came out. When they were passed around, the wistful, hungering room fell on them like a splendid dessert.
Writer Alyssa Eli remembering Doug Ashford, who died in February at the age of 53.
If you'd like to nominate someone for the Remembrance Project, send an email to remember@wbur.org or go to our website, wbur.org, for more information.
And stay with us coming up. If Boston doesn't want the Olympics, the IOC doesn't want Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.